And because Joe was a liberal influence in general, making what he thought about the Civil Rights Bill particularly important. Phil also asked Joe to bring Felix Frankfurter along. Joe later recalled that he didn't divine any ulterior motive in the invitation and certainly didn't connect it with the pending civil rights legislation. However, as he and his wife Ole and Felix drove to the farm, he began to suspect he was about to be worked on. All the way out, Felix was trying to persuade him of the overwhelming importance of voting rights. Both Phil and Felix did indeed work on Joe throughout our dinner, suggesting that he was asking for too much in wanting all the other items on the civil rights agenda at that time, e.g. real and rapid integration and enforcement of school desegregation. The argument by which Phil and Felix stood was that the most important first step for the 1950s was the right to vote. Now I can see how extraordinary and out of order it was for a Supreme Court justice to be stepping over the boundaries to this extent, but I didn't then. It was very much in Felix's nature, and he was dealing with two men, Phil and Joe, to whom he was as close as though they were his sons. And clearly he thought it was important to help Phil persuade Joe that the bill was the best they could get, and therefore that he should support it. Sometime after the brainwashing party, Johnson urged Phil to come up to Washington to be at his side during the final push for passage of the bill. So Phil returned to Washington, somewhat to my concern, and stayed with Lyndon almost constantly for several days, working day and night. A large part of his role, I believe, was to keep in touch with Joe and the liberal civil rights group with which Joe was connected. The sticking point was the jury trial amendment. Negotiations between and among the various groups lobbying for and against the bill centered largely on what would happen to this amendment. Enlisting the help of notable lawyers and legal minds, Phil worked on trying to find a formula that would be acceptable to all parties in order to get the vote to final passage. In the end, civil rights activists may have lost on the jury trial fight, but they gained a bill. Joe and his like-minded friends bought Phil's argument that this bill was better than nothing. Roy Wilkins agreed and called a meeting of the Leadership Conference of Civil Rights, which debated for an entire day. Wilkins wrote in his memoirs, "Joe argued for the bill on grounds that after 87 years, the time had finally come for a civil rights bill, even a watered-down bill, and that once Congress had lost its virginity on civil rights, it would go on to make up for what had been lost." Supporting the bill was the hardest decision of his life, Wilkins wrote. In retrospect, he knew it was the right decision. He recalls Hubert Humphrey saying to him in the middle of the struggle, "Roy, if there's one thing I have learned in politics, it's never to turn your back on a crumb." This was superb politics for Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon was still a Texas senator who had to get reelected, and the one thing they wouldn't be mad at him for in Texas was voting rights. So the whole strategy of going for voting rights was inspired, the idea for which Phil was the architect. Lady Bird Johnson, in recalling those days, described Phil and LBJ together as a sort of bridge between two very set-in-their-ways blocks of people. Phil could talk to both groups, but Lyndon couldn't talk very successfully to ardent liberals. He would talk, Lady Bird said, but they would not believe. Lyndon wrote Phil the day after passage, saying, "You stepped into the breach at the critical hour. That is something that I will never forget, and I wish there was some way of telling the country that your contribution to an effective and forcible bill was decisive." Phil used the opportunity to press his point with Lyndon about the importance of looking to his political future. He argued that Lyndon shouldn't have overt designs on the presidency. "Your present attitude strikes me as just right. Anyone who works up noticeable and passionate designs on that particular office harms himself in two ways. He begins to lose control of his own judgment. He also gives aid and comfort to the political enemy. So just sit," he advised. "Don't deny or confirm, or even conjecture. 3 years is a long, long time. All rushing and panting should be left to fellows from Tennessee and Massachusetts," referring to Kefauver and Kennedy. The effort Phil made to push the civil rights bill for Johnson was enormous, particularly coming at a time when he knew how exhausted he was. Perhaps if the turmoil had ended there, He might have been able to rest again at Glen Welby and get his strength back. Instead, just a month later, Arkansas Governor Orville Faubus ordered the National Guard to bar 9 Negro students from the previously all-white Central High School in Little Rock. The next step in the battle for civil rights was on. Since Eisenhower was not very interested except in theory and was concentrating on his vacation golf games, there was a vacuum within the administration. On the day that Press Secretary Jim Hagerty announced from Newport that the president thought patience was what was needed, the Arkansas Gazette received from a wire photo service a picture of the president lying down on a putting green, lining up a putt. They played the story on page 1 and put a caption on the picture, "Study in Patience." Into this vacuum in Washington, Phil moved swiftly and with great assurance. He was determined to solve the problem, to get the children admitted to the school peacefully, to get Faubus to back down, and above all, to prevent the federal government from having to send in troops. It was, of course, highly unlikely as a concept. Essentially, he hoped to take over the government and pull the strings of policy. At heart, Phil still felt a strong empathy with the South. He believed devoutly in school desegregation, but he also understood how hard it would be to accomplish in the face of Southern resistance. So he injected himself into the situation with frenzy as well as with conviction. Believing that he knew enough of the key players so that he could solve the problem with behind-the-scenes maneuvering, he kept several phones going day and night, calling, among others, Sherman Adams and Maxwell Rabb in the White House, Bill Rogers, about to become Attorney General, in Washington, Harry Ashmore, the fine editor of the Gazette in Arkansas, Brooks Hayes, the congressman from Little Rock, Thurgood Marshall, then head of the NAACP's Legal Defense and Educational Fund, and Roy Wilkins, still head of the NAACP. He called Joe Rao one night at 3 a.m., demanding Marshall's home telephone number. When Joe said he didn't have it, Phil ordered, "Well, goddammit, get it!" Indirectly, he was in touch with the president, ex-president Truman, and Vice President Nixon. When Eisenhower finally sent in federal troops, the violence ceased, but events in Little Rock sputtered on for 2 more years. However, the act that ended the immediate crisis, the sending in of the troops, was a crushing blow for Phil. He saw it as a defeat not only for the South, but for himself personally. Phil's activities in regard to Little Rock were the first sign for me that something was wrong with him, that his powerful talents could be used in such an idealistic but confusing and irrational way. His health, already frail, was affected physically and mentally. He held on to his activities and his balance for only another month after Little Rock before his first major depression set in. On October 28th, in the middle of the night, he broke. There is no other way to express it. All of the latent physical and psychological symptoms came to such a sudden crisis that I didn't even connect them in my mind. He was racked with pain and in despair, in a total and overwhelming depression. He wept and wept and couldn't stop. He said that he felt trapped, no longer able to go on, that everything was black. We were both up all night, with me trying desperately but to no avail to be of some reassuring help, to convince him everything would be all right. There was little I could do except stay close to him. We discovered that a hot bath helped, so he took several during the night, in an effort to stem the tears and alleviate the desperation. Early in the morning, I called my brother in Baltimore, who was at that time a psychiatrist on the staff of Johns Hopkins Hospital, describing what had happened and asking him what we should do. He gave me the name of someone at the National Institute of Mental Health who could see Phil for analysis of what was wrong and in turn recommend a psychiatrist. It was a relief to both of us to have some plan of action, with the hope of someone to lean on in this ghastly and incomprehensible crisis. Phil saw this doctor for a time or two, after which he was sent to Dr. Leslie Farber, with whom he began a long, bizarre relationship that in the end did more harm than good. I had no idea what had happened and didn't recognize what I was witnessing. I couldn't put a name to it, and didn't for a very long time to come. I only knew that Phil had had what seemed like an intense and complete nervous breakdown. which I thought had been brought on by all the activity in which he had been engaged, climaxed by Little Rock, the activity day and night, and the ensuing disappointment. It was all kept very private. Our one idea was to conceal what had happened, not only from the world, but from our friends, my family, and even our children. For some reason, beyond my initial phone call, I never even talked to my brother about what was the matter or what had brought on the crisis. As a result, I had no one on whom to lean for advice, and just concentrated on trying to be of help to Phil. Still, despite my lack of knowledge about his illness and all the unknowns, I believed that we'd get through this, that with enough rest he'd recover and we'd go on. Phil, I thought, with all his self-assurance, his glamour, his good humor, his brilliance, his wit and sagacity, would surely recover his good health, and things would return to normal. There was no need to share the temporary problem with the world, and every reason to conceal it. Chapter 14. Most of the year following Phil's breakdown was spent in slow, gradual recovery. He had all the symptoms of severe depression, overwhelming doubt about himself and his abilities, a desire to seclude himself from the world and from people, a deep uncertainty that led to indecision even about which pair of shoes to wear, guilt about whatever he felt he had done wrong, and even occasional talk of suicide. We escaped to Glen Welby whenever possible, frequently just the two of us without the children, since sometimes even dinner with them was too much for him. These long visits to Glen Welby were hard on me, because I was his only support system. There was one period of about 6 months in which he was so depressed he couldn't be alone. We hadn't been out at all, nor had I left the house, except when he visited his psychiatrist. At his most depressed, he was completely dependent on me, almost like a child. I was on duty a great deal of the time for long talks about what he was thinking. I confess I felt the need to escape at times, to lead a normal life again, to see friends, but being with someone in this kind of severe depression is compelling, and though it was grueling, there was also something strengthening in being needed that much, in being able to help him by talking about whatever was on his mind, or sometimes whatever I could think of with which to try to reach him. Gradually I learned to say whatever helped him to hear. The experience literally taught me how to talk. If I had any strength later, much of it came from surviving these exhausting months. What Phil mostly did was go to his psychiatrist, read, and think about the basic issues that someone in severe depression tends to reflect on. The doctor to whom he was sent, Leslie Farber, was heavily into existential psychology, inspired by Dr. Rollo May, an originator of the humanistic psychology school. One thing Farber did was to start Phil, and therefore me, reading existentialist philosophy, and in my case Dostoevsky, for whom I had always had an affinity. Farber himself was working on a study of the importance of will in life. It was he who instilled in Phil a distrust, fear, and horror of any drugs, not to mention shock therapy, claiming that these treatments reduced people to something less than human, something tranquilized and fish-like. In addition, Farber believed that labeling something, giving a name to a disorder, changed how the patient viewed himself and was viewed by those around him. Because of this, he never put a name to Phil's illness. I didn't hear the term manic depression until some years later. Throughout this period, I viewed what was happening with confusion and very little understanding. Farber was not a strong individual. Phil, by force of his personality, seemed to have taken charge the minute he walked into Farber's office when he told Farber he wasn't charging enough and that he, Phil, would pay more. Farber let him do so. From then on, even in his most depressed moments, Phil seemed the dominant figure in that relationship. Every rule of psychiatry was broken. Farber became a personal friend of Phil's, writing him letters, coming to visit us at R Street in Glen Welby, giving Phil some of his research and writings to edit and comment on, even at one time suggesting we visit him in Italy, where we could all drink together, not something I wanted to encourage in Phil. After each of his sessions with Farber, Phil would come home and essentially repeat all that had been said, seeming to hold nothing back, although I suppose he must have been more selective than I realized. These recappings had the effect for me of indirect participation in his therapy. At the same time, I was trying to keep the children's lives as normal as possible and the outside world unsuspecting. As a result of all this, I came close to the breaking point myself. Toward the end of January 1958, 3 months after the onset of Phil's depression, I found the weight on me more than I could bear, until one morning I felt almost physically paralyzed. But like many people, I was unable to admit I needed help and thought there might be something weak or wrong about someone not in extremis looking to psychiatry for help. Phil discussed all this with Dr. Farber, and between them they arrived at the bizarre solution that I too should begin seeing him. They suggested this as a way of keeping things secure and cohesive, but it was certainly unusual for both Phil and me to be seeing the same doctor. Never did Farber suggest that this might not be a good idea. Incredibly, there was one point in the next few years when I was going to him often and Phil was not seeing him at all. I once asked Farber if I had to keep constantly at Phil's side, if I could take a break from a weekend at Glen Welby, to which he responded that I absolutely must keep it up. I needed and was grateful for a guiding hand at that time, and Farber undoubtedly helped to some extent. But this three-way conversation was very complicating, and I didn't know enough to suggest a different program or to seek one out. For nearly a year, Phil went to the office hardly at all, occasionally for a meeting or two, or for lunch. He canceled almost all meetings and public events and never made a speech, although toward the end of that first year he participated in a panel of fathers and sons for Donald's class at St. Albans. He played golf with different partners at Burning Trees several times a week. He spent every weekend and sometimes weekdays at Glen Welby. If he traveled, it was mostly by train, since airplanes disturbed him in his depressed moods. We went out to dinner only selectively, mostly with one or two people, sometimes but rarely to larger, more social dinners. Going out at all was risky, for he often drank too much and used unacceptable language. Phil's position at the paper and in the company was such that people could understand his leading this kind of life. Many Post people knew that he was stretched thin and taking a rest, but no one knew exactly what had happened, partly because of his ability to cover up, and partly because of my help in explaining away his absences and concealing his excesses. Phil himself was unsure of what he was dealing with. Months after the breakdown, in his correspondence explaining his lack of activity, he said, "I have been taking a sort of sabbatical after several doses of flu and an accumulation of exhaustion," and that he had had a winter of boringly bad health. In one letter, he said he had pledged to my wife to limit my engagements in the near future so that I may maintain that state of rosy health which is now mine. His secretary wrote to someone that Phil was out of circulation for several months, resting under doctor's orders. Luckily, these years of his illness coincided with a period when major achievements at the paper already had been consolidated. Luckily, too, there was a strong national boom in both general business and advertising that year, which helped the paper and the business along. The paper turned a record profit of $2 million in 1957. In 1958, the Post was the only Washington paper to show a gain in advertising lineage. The Star's lead in total advertising was whittled down to 3 million lines from 18 million just 5 years before. Bad as it was, Phil's depression in 1957 was not as extreme as those that hit later. He was obviously ill, and he had several sieges of normal sicknesses as well, bouts of flu, rounds of viruses, but at this point he could still function a little if he had to. While leading this restricted life, Phil still accomplished quite a lot by means of correspondence, memos, or the telephone. He also went on working with Lyndon Johnson, occasionally meeting with him, writing him letters of advice, or drafting a speech. Johnson wrote to Phil saying how much he missed his favorite counselor, adding, "I certainly want your advice and your suggestions, because this job is so big that I need all the help I can get from the best and most enthusiastic source." Phil also turned to writing, perhaps indicating his longing for another kind of life, writing plays, some light verse, and extensive bulletins for the Lake Philip Yacht Club, extremely convoluted in their humor. He also did some writing of a more serious kind. In the summer of 1958, he wrote a highly appreciative essay book review of John Kenneth Galbraith's The Affluent Society, which appeared in the Post under the headline, "The Folly of America's Faith in Chain-Belt Living." He became enamored of a book by a French writer, Germaine Tillion, Algeria, and recommended it to everyone, sending it around to several of his friends, including Lyndon Johnson and Jack Kennedy. He wrote to Kennedy, "I am sending you a little book which you can read in 1 hour, while Jackie should only need 50 minutes. I hope you will read it. You may or may not agree with her specific ideas on Algeria, but I send it for another reason. In her analysis of underdeveloped areas in general, I think she has great wisdom about a major problem of our immediate future." I know of almost no one in the First World who was then thinking about the Third World and the importance of development. During this period, we were seeing much less of my parents, but we still gave the Post's 25th purchase anniversary party at Glen Welby in the summer of 1958. Mainly, we spent a lot of time with the Restons, and Phil met with Scotty separately for long talks, during which he again made a pitch to Scotty to come to the Post, and again got rejected. Despite being as close a friend as Phil had, Scotty disapproved of Phil's active involvement in issues on which the paper reported and his use of the paper to further his own political goals. It was during this period that Phil got to know Edward Bennett Williams, the famous criminal trial lawyer. He and Williams had met in the early summer of 1957, while Williams was defending Jimmy Hoffa, the powerhouse of the Teamsters, who was accused of bribing one of Senator John McClellan's staff. Phil was riveted by the Hoffa case, which he thought was hopeless and unwinnable. Ed later recalled that first meeting vividly. "We began to talk, and we had an instant rapport. Sometimes your chemistry flows, and you have an instant relationship with someone. You really understand one another. You can almost talk in shorthand. I was intending to go home to work, because I had a lot of work to do for the next day, but he came home with me, and we talked almost all night long. By the end of 6 hours, I felt I knew as much about Phil and he knew as much about me as there was. So we followed up on our friendship, the instant friendship, and then I realized, not too long after we met, that he had periods of depression, and he told me there would be times when he just couldn't get up in the morning. He told me one thing very early in our relationship. 'You know, if you ever don't want to get up, if you want to pull back the sheet and drapes and not let the sun in, you've got to force yourself. You've just got to force yourself. You've got to drive yourself to go open those drapes and let the daylight in. You cannot stay in that room.' Like all people who are in that kind of depression, they don't know why they are in depression. My feeling always was that he was terribly troubled by a self-doubt. Whether he could have been as successful as he was if he hadn't married you. In other words, whether or not he would have hit the heights that he did professionally if he hadn't been Kay Graham's husband, Eugene Meyer's son-in-law, and hadn't had the Post stock given to him. Whether he would have made it as just Phil Graham, out of Harvard Law School with great grades, Felix Frankfurter's law clerk. I used to say to him, 'How in hell can you have doubt when you were Felix Frankfurter's clerk?' Just to be a Supreme Court clerk meant that, in those days, you were probably one of the 18 best law students in America and out of the best law school in America with an academic record at the very top of that school. It was inevitable that he was going to be a top-flight success, but that doubt drove him absolutely bananas." Phil told me in great detail all about his meetings with Ed, but he didn't bring him home. I remember meeting Ed and his first wife, Dorothy, but a joint friendship didn't develop then. The relationship was between the two men. Ed and I became warm friends only much later. Phil told me about his first meeting with Dorothy, who had been born with a deformed arm. Upon meeting her, Phil did one of those breathtaking things which came to him so naturally. He said, "Hi, kid, what's the matter with your wing?" She apparently loved the honest, benign curiosity, compared with the way many people ignored her arm or looked the other way. So, despite his continuing lethargy, Phil engaged in various minor activities, making his usual impact. He arranged for a car to be given to Walter Lippmann for his 70th birthday, which Lippmann immediately traded for one he preferred. He conferred with Lyndon Johnson, convincing him to push the D.C. Home Rule Bill, for which we had both worked for so long. He spoke to post-meetings of stockholders and employees. These little incursions into the world were definite steps forward, and it's hard to reconcile them with the way he was still feeling. Except for Farber, I spoke to no one about Phil or what was wrong, and this was eating me up. Phil liked me to be there when he came home from seeing Farber, so I always arranged to be at home for him at those times. What I did otherwise, perhaps as part of our cover-up of the real situation, was to step up my involvement in welfare work. I kept meeting with all the organizations with which I was involved, the children's schools, the boards, and so on, and entered a more interesting phase of my work with the Department of Public Welfare, involving an in-depth study of how to get children out of the district's Dickensian dumping ground, Junior Village. Although I was trying hard, I certainly didn't understand Phil or respond to his needs well enough during this time. I don't know now, and certainly didn't then, how much pressure he felt because of his son-in-law status at the post. It's possible that he really wanted out of our marriage, but felt he couldn't get out because of the paper. But by the time I might have acknowledged that, his illness was so evident that it was impossible to sort out what was driven by the illness and what were his underlying feelings. Throughout these first years of his illness, Phil remained the dominant figure by far in the family. Yet I had some say. I was the foundation, the stability. I can't remember exactly when he suggested just picking up, taking the children out of school, and living abroad for a while, but it must have been around the beginning of 1958. I thought this idea was much too out of the ordinary. To leave his job, uproot the children, put everyone in French schools? It all seemed unthinkable. Was he right? I'm not sure, but I know I wasn't able to face the idea at the time. Actually, it may have been a good idea, and was certainly typical of his inventive zest for life. He was undoubtedly feeling pressures from which he wanted to escape, and we might all have profited from it. In the summer of 1958, after months of going slow, Phil wrote to his father, "I am beginning to feel quite a bit better, but it has been a slow process. I still get tired more than I like, and I guess I will have to continue at reduced speed for a few more months. If it were not for that, I would grab a plane and fly down for a visit." Actually, at this point, Phil was even less connected to his own family than he was to mine, but he was still explaining his absence as a need to lie low for a while and get his strength back. By the summer and fall of 1958, Phil was starting to do a little more, but only a little. Yet his business instincts continued to function at a high level. He was in negotiations that continued over a long period to buy the Greensboro News and Record in North Carolina, the town's only newspaper, and the owner of Greensboro's only TV station, WFMY, a CBS affiliate, at a cost of $7 million. The deal finally fell through because of the reluctance of a member of the family who owned the paper, but Phil had nursed it along for months. He then devoted the same energy to planning new buildings at already existing properties, one for WJXT in Jacksonville, and the other, a $5 million addition to the Post building, to be completed in 1960. Meanwhile, my own life evolved to accommodate Phil's changed one and the changing needs of my four children and my aging parents. Mother called us a great deal and had her ways of letting us know if we hadn't been attentive enough. She would hint about how much she'd seen of her other children, e.g., "Ruthie is so wonderful, she calls every day," or make not-so-subtle statements about how thoughtful Biss had been. My visits to her remained mostly one-sided. Actually, after 1957, this was helpful to me. It was easy to keep from her Phil's illness or how I felt about it, since she rarely asked about me and didn't take time to listen when she did ask. Like Phil, she had frequent bouts of colds, flu, or even pneumonia. She stayed in bed most of one winter, I suspect there was some depression along with whatever ailed her, and drank pretty continually, too. Then, just as Phil began to get a little better, my father began to deteriorate, adding to my deep concerns. In his early 80s, he was declining sharply. He was also increasingly a problem for my mother, who looked to Phil and me to help her with him. She was having a hard time concentrating on her work because he was often in a dark and difficult mood, and she poured out her heart in a letter to me, saying that more and more she was anxious over Dad's state of mind, and she thought we ought to know how precariously he is poised between stability and neuroses. She continued, "I actually get frightened about the future. When he was strong, I could fight back. That is out of the question now. He conquers through weakness, and I am helpless. The only people who can help me, therefore, are you and, let's admit it, especially Phil, who can say anything because he is the one person who can do no wrong." For the next 2 years, as she struggled with Dad's increasing debility, she relied on us, especially me, more than ever, keeping up her trips and leaving us in charge of him. One day I was surprised to read an interview with her in a New York paper in which she discussed the role of women, about how a woman could have her own work but always had to take care of her husband first. She actually said that before she left on trips, she always arranged to have my father kept busy and kept company. The arrangement, of course, consisted of calling me and asking me to lay on bridge games and companions. Since I was extremely busy by this time and had no secretary, which she did, not to mention being consumed by Phil's illness, I was indignant. As Mother became even more absorbed in her work and in herself, we became my father's mainstay, and he too became increasingly reliant on Phil and me. He would come over in search of company, and occasionally lean on us about his problems, often complaining about my mother's drinking. When his adored older sister, Rosalie Stern, died, we told him the news. He was devastated and broke into tears. After Phil's breakdown, it became harder for me to be there for my father always. In protecting Phil, I unfortunately never shared with my father, or anyone else, what was wrong. I wasn't embarrassed, it was just something very private, something we both still assumed he'd get over. And there was the stigma of mental illness. Phil once said to Don, "This means I can never be in the cabinet." Dad must have been puzzled and worried by Phil's health, but luckily he died before things with Phil came to a crisis. He was so devoted to Phil that it would have been an unbearable blow for him. I believe there were three main people on whom my father had bestowed his love and affection and respect: his brother Edgar and his partner Gerald Henderson, both of whom died young, and Phil. My father's feelings for me were very strong, but I couldn't fill the role any of those three played in his life. Phil reciprocated his feelings and showed it in almost all of their encounters and relations. He expressed them in a birthday letter he wrote to my father a few days after his breakdown. I can imagine how much strength he would have needed to summon up just to put pen to paper. "I have no aversion to friends, and in fact I have a group, which, while not multitudinous, is more of a host than I need or deserve. Of all these I want to say that none is as close or as integral as you." Early in 1959, Phil and I decided to take the children to Europe for a couple of months during the summer. Lally would be 16 and Don 14, and we thought it was about the last time we could take these older two on a sightseeing tour. One day that spring I had seen my father cough up blood, after which he shook his head and said to me, "Not good." I didn't then know exactly what he meant, but he must have known it suggested a tumor on his lung. His condition affected me deeply, for I realized he must be slowly dying. It was utterly shattering, and left me with a gnawing grief and constant anxiety. I was terribly torn about leaving him at that time, and still don't understand why I did. The trip had seemed like a good idea in the planning, and I didn't have much will of my own. It was hard to foresee how long my father's decline might go on, but his doctor felt that his condition was pretty stable, and that the decline probably would be slow but steady, conceding, of course, a surprise always possible. Even my mother put her imprimatur on my going by writing me, "Do not worry about me. Dad is so patient, so philosophical, that it is exalting to be with him. When Adlai was here and felt sad for me, I said firmly, 'I am not to be pitied, I am to be envied.' That's the way things are, darling. Throw yourself into every experience, knowing that all will be for the best over here. I was somewhat reassured when Phil stayed behind to finish some business and to be with Dad. Phil took us to New York, and the four children and I set off for Paris on June 24th. I thought about my father all the time, particularly when I received a letter from Mother saying that my brother Bill's son would be bicycling in France, and adding, "So the third generation spreads its wings, just as the man who, unknown to them, has provided them with security, is getting ready to fold his wings forever." Despite my remorse about not being home, the whole time we were in Europe I felt I had been transported to another world. As I wrote Phil, "I feel so remote that I can't even in my imagination get back to Crescent Place, R Street." Phil at home was attending to my parents' needs, relieving Mother of some of the tension of visiting Dad at the hospital, where he had gone when he had taken a turn for the worse. Phil reported on one lunch he had with my mother that "reminded me of some of your experiences." To keep it going, I mentioned Lally's asking me about Zen Buddhism. Wham! It turns out that definitive, seminal, etc. discussion of this is in Aggie's Chinese art book. Thought you'd be glad to know. One letter Phil wrote to me from Glenn Welby in that interlude before he joined us in Europe still gives me profound pleasure and comfort. What followed in the next several years, all the illness and chaos and heartache, left me so confused about what Phil truly felt that I like to think it was this letter from the distant past that reflected his true feelings. It was written at a moment when the depression was subsiding and he seemed to be nearing a balance, when the old Phil emerged again, the one I knew and loved. "This is such a curious, curious place alone. All places are, but this most, and R Street next. A couple of hours ago, I thought of J. Alsop on that Sunday afternoon in our house just a week ago, and his saying about his loss of not having a family. Then I gave it no credence, that is, none of the heart, and to the mind only, that sort of loss doesn't seem so much. When the heart gets working along with the mind, then that is when you imagine, which is why imagination is probably one of the biggest human capacities. It's not all clear to me how much J. Alsop feels the loss, but it is certainly clear that no one can feel a loss who hasn't first had a family as much as the feeling gets to be to one who has. Loss is a pretty inaccurate, blown-up word for a few days' absence. Absence doesn't come close to what I'm thinking. What am I thinking? Reminder, I believe, is the point. A home, to reverse the madam's phrase, is not a house, but a great big store of memories, and if that is why a home is good, it is also why a home alone is almost unbearable. Just before sunset, to take one example, the softening light was ending so surely and so gently that no one could afford to ignore it, to lose it unnoticed in a house. And also there were our friends, the dogs. So I tossed me up a large beaker of scotch and ice, and whistled them up, and banged out the front screen down the gate to the dusty driveway, where they headed at once toward Lake K. "No," I called, "no, no," and I whistled them back. "We're going up the drive to the gate, as Mummy does." And we swung along, George all tired, until on the curve by the woodmill he saw a rabbit and dashed clear to the bridge with the speed of wind, unsuccessful once again. As we neared the dip in the drive near the bridge, I could see you heavy and sad the way I saw you over a year ago as I stood down at the barn and watched you walking alone and heavy with cares and a similar dusk. Those cares caused by me. Can I wash them away? Can I tidy them up like a month's end bank account by saying, "Ah, but there were my cares too, heavy and also having cause"? Oh no, my memory will not go away, nor will it cancel out. Nor does it bear me down in the facile lament of mea culpa. Those cares you walked along so heavily burdened with, they are memory too, part of the long story. As I knew when we reached the bridge, and the three of them hurled their hot selves through the weeds into the cool pool of the run. That bridge was memory too, a thousand memories, and one especially of a dark, dark night, when I was as dark as the night was, and sat on that bridge, and talk to my good red dog. Just beyond the bridge, the edge of the woods was bright with the bloom of daylilies, and they leaped across the drive and started again around the foundation of the old tenant house where they were joined by brilliant red hollyhocks. And just then three separate quail called from the quiet of the woods behind me, and I said to myself, "You must remember every bit of all you saw and tell Kay." What did we do? Glorious dinner last night, Vicky's and Nicky's, friendly, 13th birthday, with Earlene's fried chicken, Susie Bell's cake, and your champagne. Then bridge. Then today a bit of baking tennis, and then Agnes down for lunch. Really too hot for her to walk to Lake Kay, but she and I paced up and down under the front elms in a great breeze while the F's swam. Then chairs and a drink table under the front elms in the breeze, and Jean, friendly, worked the wearing mixer and rum, and we ate a chicken salad the chef sent down, and Earlene's hamburgers, and more of the cake and ice cream. A good day for Ag till 3:30, and then more bridge till 5 when the F's left, and then I thought, what if Kay did say not to be here alone? I'd rather be lonely here than in town, so my pearls and I jeeped to Lake P and tried some dull fishing but too hot, and then came back, and then, as I said, saw the sun setting and walked into it. So I'll sleep here, and rise earlyish, and drive up for breakfast in town. Next Sunday's sunset I shall see with you in Paris, also from a bridge, if you will kindly arrange that. Until then, my dearest, I hope you will accept this which is meant to be, by God it is, a love letter. Your burden and your sustainer, and always yours, in love, Phil. The children loved the vacation from beginning to end. In Paris, they often explored alone. The four of them went together to the roof of the Arc de Triomphe, took horse and buggy rides and bus rides, on one of which Donnie got shut in the door, and when she came to his rescue, Lally was saved by an Englishwoman from an altercation with the bus driver. The children and I had a warm, familial time, interspersed with raucous moments, like Don going off to the races at Saint-Cloud by himself, returning a big winner. When Phil arrived in Paris to meet us, he reported that my father had gone home and then back to the hospital. Mother had tried to run a hospital of sorts for him at Crescent Place, but as Phil pointed out, she had neither the temperament nor the competence for the job. Everyone had convinced her that my father was better off in the hospital. Phil was certain we had done the right thing by carrying on with our trip. Despite some alarms, the situation was the same, he thought, i.e., slow deterioration. Company was now almost meaningless to my father, and Mother had Bis, Bill, and Ruth there to help. I felt, with good reason, horribly torn. Today I can see that the summer was wonderful for the children, but wrong for me. I can hardly bear to think that I left my father's side when he was dying. From Venice, Phil wrote a moving letter to my mother. At 5:45 this morning, I awakened thinking of you and these last weeks, and I decided I had from now on to call you by your name, which I think you will understand. Kay was wakeful, too, a little later, and we talked of you so warmly in the dark with the morning canal noises just beginning as a background below our windows. It seems to me that love comes very hard for you, it probably does for all of us, and to most of us never comes and never even missed, has always come hard for you. And now it is with you, a powerful, shaking, terrifying, beautiful love for that gallant old man. You say poor words about having a job to do and being able to stand anything, and you are right to obfuscate, because the true words are too seismic. But he knows what is in you, and it is the fulfillment of his life. His cup runneth over, and mine too, in pangs of joy for both of you. We left Venice for a simple hotel at the beach resort of Forte dei Marmi, and there we received word that my father had taken a real turn for the worse, and we should return at once. Phil and I left the children with the college girl who was traveling with us and flew back to New York and on to Washington, which took 16 hours. The thought of being there at his death disturbed me so deeply that I was torn between wanting to see him and hoping it had already happened. He died 2 days after we got back, but he knew I was there. People react in such complicated ways to any death, but particularly to the death of a parent, because a lot of what one feels is about oneself and the sense that nothing now stands between that self and dying. You have now become the older generation. I believe that the closer and more loving the relationship is, the deeper but simpler the grief. Of my father's children, my brother had the hardest time with his death, perhaps because their relationship was difficult to begin with, and very ambivalent. Through no fault of either of them, they had never been close. My mother was so complicated emotionally to begin with that his death was very hard for her. She had chafed under the burden of his aging, but when he died she sank into a deep depression. It was as if she had been leaning against a door that had suddenly burst open. There was a private service for my father at Crescent Place, and a more public memorial service at the nearby All Souls Unitarian Church, one he had never attended. I suppose it was hard to hit on an appropriate spot for a non-religious Jew. My parents' friend, Chief Justice Earl Warren, delivered a eulogy, which I think was written by Sidney Hyman. Rudolf Serkin played with his quartet. The whole thing was simple and moving, and I couldn't believe he was gone. A week later, we left Washington to return to pick up the children in Rome. In our absence, they had all fallen in love with Italy and the mad Italians. The children were good travelers and good sports about everything, even helping with Steve, then only 7. By the time we arrived in London, we were having such a good time that we decided to prolong our stay by almost 3 weeks and to return by steamer, the Mauritania. For me, the trip had been wonderful in its way, despite my grief and my guilty feelings about my father, which persist to this day. For Phil, the trip was a forward step in his recovery. He was considerably more active that fall. His activity was mostly related to politics. He stepped up his connection with Lyndon Johnson. He also accepted some invitations to speak to various groups, an indication of his near recovery, or at least his return to some balance. Although he hadn't spoken publicly for a long time, 2 speeches he gave, one at the end of 1959 and another in February 1960, were vintage Phil, with the added dimension that they were full of thoughts on the necessity for understanding the meaning of one's life. In the first, to the American Electric Power Company in Canton, Ohio, he spoke about the shaking loneliness that a man experiences, whatever his job, whenever he faces up to the meaning of what he is engaged in. "Where I get in difficulty, at times almost unbearable difficulty, is when I try to examine the meaning of what I am engaged in. When these difficulties get too great, we in the newspaper business retreat to the ritual of reciting old rules that we know are meaningless. We say that we just print the objective news in our news columns and confine our opinions to the editorial page, yet we know that while this has some merit as an oversimplified slogan of good intentions, it also has a strong smell of pure baloney. If we keep wages too low in some few areas where unions still let us do it, or if we neglect decent working amenities as long as we can avoid the cost, we defend ourselves by muttering about our concern for stockholders, as though by announcing compassion for a relatively anonymous and absent group, we can justify a lack of compassion for people we spend our working days with. If we are brutally careless about printing something that maligns the character of some concrete individual, we are apt to wave the abstract flag of freedom of speech in order to avoid the embarrassment of a concrete apology. If we are pressed even harder, we may salve our consciences by saying that, after all, there are libel laws. And as soon as we say that, we redouble our efforts to make those laws as toothless as we possibly can. And if we are pressed really quite hard, we can finally shrug our shoulders and say, well, after all, we have to live. Then we can only hope no one will ask the ultimate question, why? I certainly have been guilty of all those stupid actions, and a great many more stupid, and I suppose that more than a few of you have done as poorly. What I prefer to recall are those rare occasions when I have had some better sense of the meaning of what I am engaged in. In those moments I have realized that our problems are relatively simple, and that some simple, ancient moral precepts are often reliable business tools. In those moments, I have been able to keep in mind that it really doesn't matter whether I am kept in my job. In those moments, I have been able to look straight at the frailty of my judgment. And finally, I have been honest enough to recognize that a few, A very few great issues about the meaning of life are the only issues which deserve to be considered truly complex. By paying attention to the broader meaning of what we are engaged in, we may be able to join our passion to our intelligence. And such a juncture, even on the part of but one individual, can represent a significant step forward on the long road toward civilization. The whole political year of 1960 was very exciting. There is a thrill to knowing someone of your generation who runs for and actually becomes president. By the late 1950s, we had gotten to know Jack Kennedy. Early in 1956, he had been one of four speakers at the post-sponsored book and author luncheon, on hand as the author of Profiles in Courage. According to a Post article reporting on the luncheon, the young senator delighted a largely feminine audience by quipping, "I always used to wonder what the ladies did in Washington in the daytime." Senator Kennedy was one of the people we knew much better than we normally would have because of Joe Alsop, who had decided very rapidly that he was all for Kennedy. Phil and I had seen the Kennedys at big parties, looking glamorous and handsome, but I never took him seriously. I remember exclaiming to Joe when he said, sometime around 1958, that he thought Kennedy would be president one day, "Joe, surely you're not serious. You don't really think Kennedy could be president, do you?" Joe said, "Darling, I think he will certainly be nominated and quite probably be elected." The Kennedys had recently moved into a house on N Street in Georgetown, and in the late fall of 1958 or early winter of 1959, Joe invited us to dinner with them. Phil had too much to drink and was visibly and audibly out of control. I was embarrassed, probably too much so, but impressed with Kennedy for his cool approach, which ignored it totally and treated Phil as though he were perfectly sober. I admired that and was grateful. After the other guests left, we and the Kennedys, urged by Joe, stayed on. Phil looked Kennedy straight in the eye and said, "Jack, you are very good. You will be president some day. But you are too young and you shouldn't run yet." To which Kennedy replied, "Well, Phil, I'm running and this is why. First, I think I'm as well qualified as anybody who is going to run, except for Lyndon Johnson. Second, if I don't run, whoever wins will be there for 8 years and will influence who his successor will be. And third, if I don't run, I'll have to stay in the Senate at least 8 more years. As a potential candidate in the Senate, I'll have to vote politically, and I'll end up as both a mediocre senator and a lousy candidate." I was thoroughly impressed by this, and each time I saw Senator Kennedy, I grew more impressed. We also got to know Jack and Jackie better through Bill Walton, their painter friend and ours. One night we went to a dinner at Bill's with the Kennedys. Also there was Frances Ann Hersey, an acquaintance of mine from Madeira School, and by then the divorced wife of the writer John Hersey. As Frances Ann Cannon, daughter of the wealthy linen manufacturer in the South, she had had a romance with Jack in college. He had apparently proposed to her, and she had turned him down, or so she told Bill. Somehow Jack had gotten back his love letters, and Jackie had read them, so when Bill called Jackie and suggested this dinner, she responded, "Oh, wonderful! I would rather meet her than any other woman in the world." Bill enlisted our help as neutral parties. We accepted, and arrived with great anticipation, particularly because Phil hadn't then spent many hours with Jack in such a small group. Bill later recalled the evening, remembering Frances dressed seductively in a short and revealing black dress, switching along to attract. Jack greeted her with kindness, but didn't seem to speak to her again. From her point of view, Bill said, it was a disaster. Jack and Phil, however, went to each other like magnets and talked solidly all evening. As Bill said, they were both at their best, and it was a really important evening for both of them. And Jackie was in heaven because she saw her old rival being rejected. On January 2, 1960, Kennedy formally announced his decision to seek the presidency. Johnson declared only a few days before the convention. What a difference between that and the current process! The Post at the time of Kennedy's announcement editorialized that he had a tenacity of purpose and maturity of judgment, an acute awareness of the great issues of the day. By now, Phil was much better, though he still had moments of depression and at least 2 periods that year of health problems followed by 2-week vacations or getaways that allowed him to rest. He was in balance, but only precariously. He was on the edge of a manic period that built with his growing and still constructive involvement in the political dynamics of that crucial year of 1960. Very early on, Phil predicted that Kennedy and Johnson would be the only candidates to come into the Democratic convention with sizable blocks of delegates, 500 for Kennedy and 300 for Johnson, he thought. He had visions of Kennedy's not making it and Adlai Stevenson's emerging as the compromise northern candidate. In June 1960, Kennedy, as had Nixon before him, came to an editorial lunch at the Post. At that point, he had entered and run in 7 primaries, including the roughest, in West Virginia, where only 5% of the population was Catholic. I recall Jackie saying later that Caroline's first words were, "West Virginia." Kennedy had clearly demonstrated he was a vote-getter. Much of the luncheon talk concerned Nixon, who was regarded as the almost certain Republican nominee. Eddie Folliard, still the Post's key political reporter, asked Kennedy if he would debate Nixon on television if it turned out that both of them were their party's nominees for the presidency. Kennedy said he would. Reminded of Nixon's reputation as a debater, Kennedy calmly added, "I think I can take him." Asked about the possibility of Lyndon Johnson as vice president, Kennedy scoffed at the idea, saying he felt sure Johnson wouldn't accept it. Russ Wiggins disagreed, feeling that Johnson would like to broaden his horizon as vice president. Although the interview was off the record, both these exchanges, about the debate and about the potential running mate, were of great help to those covering the convention and the rest of the campaign. These days, all such interviews are done on the record and therefore take on an entirely different significance and are sometimes, I think, less helpful. On July 5th, Johnson held a press conference at which he announced his candidacy. Phil, who had been helping him prepare for this moment for months, was at his side working on his statement. He ended up on his hands and knees, crawling around at the last minute to retrieve one of Lyndon's contact lenses which had popped out. The announcement got made, and Johnson went to New York to meet with the press and do all the ritual things. Phil and I flew to California early, 5 days before the Democratic convention was to open on July 11th. I was already committed to Kennedy. Phil remained loyal to Johnson until he lost the bid for the nomination, but he was entirely realistic, and he too admired JFK. My mother, a year after my father's death, was beginning to come out of her depression. Like the rest of us, she had geared up for politics in this election year and arrived in Los Angeles still staunchly supporting Adlai Stevenson, who, as usual, had declined to be a candidate, but was eligible for a draft. On Friday, July 8th, Johnson arrived, the first of the candidates. Almost immediately, he confided to his office staff, "It's all over with. It's going to be Kennedy by a landslide." Only Kennedy had a sophisticated organization already in place in Los Angeles. It was the first time we saw electronic communications between people working in different places, talking to each other through handheld intercoms and beepers, now so routine. It was very impressive. Phil called on Bobby Kennedy and got from him confidential figures on his brother's strength, numbers that showed JFK very close to the number of votes needed to win the nomination, close enough so that the Pennsylvania delegation, or a big chunk of it, could put him over. On Monday, Pennsylvania caucused and announced that the state delegation would give 64 of its 81 votes to Kennedy, which made Phil and the Post reporters write that it would be Kennedy on the first ballot. At that point, Phil got together with Joe Alsup to discuss the merits of Lyndon Johnson as Kennedy's running mate. Joe persuaded Phil to accompany him to urge Kennedy to offer the vice presidency to Johnson. Joe had all the secret passwords, and the two men got through to Evelyn Lincoln, Kennedy's secretary, in a room next to his dreary double bedroom and living room. They took a seat on one of the beds and nervously talked out who would say what while they observed what Joe termed the antechambers of history. Joe decided he would introduce the subject, and Phil should make the pitch. When they were then taken to the living room to see JFK, Joe opened with, "We've come to talk to you about the vice presidency. Something may happen to you, and Symington is far too shallow a puddle for the United States to dive into. Furthermore, what are you going to do about Lyndon Johnson? He's much too big a man to leave up in the Senate. Then Phil spoke, shrewdly and eloquently, according to Joe, pointing out all the obvious things that Johnson could add to the ticket, and noting that not having Johnson on the ticket would certainly be trouble. Kennedy immediately agreed, so immediately as to leave me doubting the easy triumph, Phil noted in a memo afterwards. So I restated the matter, urging him not to count on Johnson's turning it down, but to offer the VP ship so persuasively as to win Johnson over. Kennedy was decisive in saying that was his intention, pointing out that Johnson could help not only in the South, but elsewhere in the country. Phil told the Post's reporters they could write that the word in L.A. is that Kennedy will offer the vice presidency to Lyndon Johnson. On Tuesday morning, Kennedy called Phil, who told JFK he was to lunch with Johnson and would get back to him afterwards. But when Phil lunched alone with Johnson, he was unable to bring up the subject. By clerical error, the Kennedy staff had sent to the Texas delegation a form telegram asking that Kennedy be invited to appear before them. The Johnson staff seized on it and asked for a debate before both the Texas and Massachusetts delegations at 3 p.m. that day. Johnson was bone-tired from a grueling morning appearing before three or four delegations, but was tremendously exhilarated by the prospect of the debate, which breathed life into his candidacy. At 1:50, Phil, egged on by the Johnson staff, persuaded LBJ to take a nap, and together with the couple from his ranch who had come along to help, got him into pajamas and into bed. While putting him to bed, Phil said, "We're not going to be ad hominem. We're going to talk about the world. Walter Lippmann came out for Kennedy this morning, saying you were an ignoramus about the world, and we're going to show him he's wrong." Johnson fell asleep at once, and Phil scribbled out some thoughts and had them typed. At 2:50, Phil handed a sleepy Johnson his notes, and at 3 o'clock, Johnson appeared at the debate looking rested and well. Kennedy spoke first, then Johnson, using Phil's notes, but continuing on ad lib with some thrusts at Kennedy, which he kept within the bounds of propriety, according to Phil. Later Tuesday, Phil got the wild idea of a message from Kennedy to the convention to be read by Stevenson on Thursday, asking the delegates to draft Johnson for vice president. Just before he went to bed, he left me a note to call Steve Smith and ask for a Kennedy appointment. 1. Don't think me bereft of my senses. I have a hell of an important idea. 2. Therefore, please call MA6-3592, say you're calling for Phil Graham and want Steve Smith, and it is important. 3. Tell Smith who you are and say, I had a 5 o'clock in the morning inspiration as to how to accomplish the substance of the 2 items Senator Kennedy discussed with Joe Alsop and me. It will take 5 minutes to lay before the senator, but this should be done before the Wednesday session, either at the Biltmore or at his house near the convention. I can arrive either place within less than an hour. I asked you to convey this because I am sleeping owing to early morning inspiration. I woke Phil at 9:30 to tell him he had an appointment at 10:40. Kennedy appeared with the increasing aura of a nominee and suggested Phil ride across town with him. As they rode along on Wednesday morning, Phil explained his idea, and Kennedy said to leave it with Mrs. Lincoln. He said he might be 20 votes short of nomination, with the nominating session to begin in 4 hours, and asked Phil if he could get any Johnson votes out of the vice presidency offer. Phil replied he could think of none, unless George Smathers would try to swing some of Florida's votes, to which Kennedy responded that the trouble was, Smathers also wanted to be vice president. Phil then assured Kennedy that he'd never miss the nomination by 20 votes. Indeed, that afternoon, Kennedy was nominated. Unbeknownst to Phil at the time, the previous afternoon, Kennedy had formally offered the vice presidency to Symington through Clark Clifford. After conferring with his wife and 2 sons, who were opposed to the idea, Symington told Clark to accept, but added presciently, "I bet you $100 that no matter what he says, Jack will not make me his running mate. He will have to pick Lyndon." Clark called Kennedy back and accepted for Symington. Early Thursday morning, Kennedy called Johnson, waking him up and making an appointment to see him a little later. At that meeting, he offered him the vice presidency, both because he thought he had to and because he thought that Johnson would not accept. Kennedy went back to his headquarters and, according to Arthur Schlesinger in Robert Kennedy and his Times, told Bobby, "You just won't believe it. He wants it." Phil had been right. Johnson would indeed accept. Everyone around the Kennedys, especially those connected with the labor movement, was upset. Apparently, they all spent much of the day thinking how they could undo what they had done. Bobby went down to see Lyndon twice, once to feel him out, and the second time to tell him that there was going to be a lot of opposition, that it was going to be unpleasant, and to offer him instead the chairmanship of the Democratic National Committee. In the meantime, Joe and I and some others arrived at the Biltmore and entered the grill for lunch. Phil said, "Order me a roast beef sandwich and I'll be back." He disappeared, and for the next couple of hours, people joined us, ate Phil's sandwich, and left, and others sat down. We reordered the sandwich several times, and it kept getting eaten by friends who came along. Phil never came back. Finally, we broke up, and as I started down a long hall toward the Post's headquarters, I met Betty Beale, society columnist for the Evening Star, running toward me. "Have you heard?" she exclaimed. "No, what?" "It's Johnson." "Who says?" I asked. "Kennedy says," she replied firmly. He had just said it in the bowl, which was a small auditorium on the floor below, where the press offices were, used for public announcements. I went on to our offices, where Phil shortly appeared in a state of high tension, almost trembling all over, and said, "You can't believe what I've just been through. Let's get out of here, and I'll tell you." At a restaurant in the convention center, he grabbed a drink and sandwich and told me the story of what had happened. When Phil had appeared in the Johnson suite at about 1:45 p.m., Johnson seized his arm and said that Bobby Kennedy was with Sam Rayburn, Speaker of the House and Lyndon's great mentor, offering Johnson the vice presidency. Phil said he thought he had to take it. Lady Bird was somewhere between negative and neutral. The evening before, Rayburn had called especially to tell him not to take it if offered. Rayburn entered and said Bobby wanted to see Lyndon. Lady Bird felt he shouldn't meet with Bobby. Phil agreed, saying, "You don't want it. You won't negotiate for it. You'll only take it if Jack drafts you, and you won't discuss it with anyone else." Finally, as Phil wrote, "In that sudden way decisions leap out of a melee, it was decided." Mr. Sam went off to explain the Johnson position to Bobby, and Phil was to phone Jack with LBJ's position. By this time, Jim Rowe and John Connolly had joined the nucleus, and Phil went down the public hall, crowded with press, to an empty bedroom. He finally got JFK on the phone and gave him the Johnson message. Kennedy responded that he was having trouble with people urging him to take Symington, as someone who was trouble-free, and that Phil should call back in 3 minutes. By this time, Phil and Jim Rowe were in a state of nerves, or as Phil described it, as calm as Chileans on top of an earthquake. Each time he wanted to reach Jack, Phil had to go through a telephonic obstacle course, Mrs. Lincoln to Steve Smith or Sarge Shriver, then finally to JFK. On the phone, Kennedy was calm. "It's all set," he said. "Tell Lyndon I want him." He asked Phil also to tell Stevenson and ask for his full support. Phil called Adlai first, then walked back down the hall to give the message to Johnson, who quizzed him for details. Lady Bird wondered about Stevenson's reaction, to which Phil shrugged and said, "Oh, you know, sort of silk underwear, as you'd expect." Phil then left the room to call the Post. Soon, however, LBJ asked him to return, saying Bobby had been back to see Rayburn about 20 minutes before and had said Jack would phone directly, but there had been no call, and what should he do? Phil volunteered to call Jack, who said he had assumed Phil's message from him to LBJ would suffice. Phil told him what Bobby had told Rayburn, and he said he'd call at once. According to Phil, Kennedy again mentioned opposition to LBJ and asked Phil what he thought. Phil replied that Southern gains would more than offset liberal losses, and added that, anyway, it was too late to be mind-changing and that he should remember, "You ain't no Adlai." Phil was still trying to reach Bobby shortly after 4 p.m. when Bill Moyers, LBJ's appointment secretary, came in and said Johnson needed him at once, and dragged him by the arm through the packed hall to Johnson's suite. Lyndon took Phil into an adjoining room to avoid one filled with some political types, but they found this other room occupied with 15 Hawaiian delegates. When Johnson called out that he needed the room, they solemnly filed out, bowing in turn to all of us at the door, LBJ, Lady Bird, Rayburn, Connolly, Rowe, and me, with LBJ loudly chanting, "Thank you, boys, thank you for all you did." LBJ, about to jump out of his skin, shouted at Phil that Bobby Kennedy had told Rayburn and him that there was so much opposition he should withdraw for the sake of the party,